This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Staub Audio Engineering. If you have listened to any of the episodes, you have undoubtedly heard me talk about Mike and the phenomenal audio engineering work that he does. His mixes and masters are truly some of the best that I've ever heard. I love working with Mike on all of our Dreamfield tunes, on all of our Summit One tunes. He is an absolute wizard. Make sure to hit him up, inquire about mixing and mastering prices, and take your tracks to the next level. Oh, yeah. And Mike is also one of the nicest, kindest human beings you'll ever meet. Definitely hit him up and work with him.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all of the producers, artists, and creators that are tuning into the show. My name is Cody Christensen, and you are listening to the Chilled Samples Podcast.
So stoked to have you on. You and I have been we've talked pretty regularly for a couple years, if not a few years at this point, man. So I'm really excited to be able to have you on an episode and to hear your story in depth. And of course, I don't want to take your story from you, but you're also an extremely active individual, which we share that in common. So I'm excited to dive
Definitely.
Into your athletic practices and mindfulness practices. But before we get to that, Seth, how are you doing, man?
Awesome. Well, I'm thrilled to be on here. I'm doing really good. I think listening to this podcast and reaching out to some of the folks or some of the guests that had been on really like helped launch my solo career with the whole lo-fi thing. So I'm really grateful for that. And I think, you know, being a long time regular listener and then actually getting a chance to come on here is really cool.
Man. Well, as a podcast host, that is so cool to hear, man. And, I had no idea what this podcast was going to turn into when I started it. And it's been just an absolute joy. And to see all of the different connections flourish between guests of the podcast has been pretty spectacular to see how that is branched out. So Seth, thank you, man. And all credit goes to the universe and powers greater than myself, certainly for however this show came to be. Seth, for people who aren't familiar with you, just give us a little description of your project and what you do.
Yeah, totally. I'm based in Philadelphia, in the Northwest Philadelphia, in an area called Germantown. Americans might be familiar with the Battle of Germantown. It was like a big Revolutionary War battle. So that's the neighborhood that I'm in. I'm a producer and trumpet player. I've been producing lo-fi under a couple projects, although now my main project is called Casket Pretty. Spelled with a V instead of an A. And I did have a project previously called Santa Rita, which sort of got me started in the lo-fi world. Before that, I've been in, playing trumpet in some different capacities, but I was mostly doing production for rappers and singers before, doing some live like R&B and hip hop bands. But then, of course, with the pandemic, things shifted and there were a lot of new opportunities, and I, like many others, you know, started shifting towards, you know, doing much more studio-based, production-based stuff and very little live gigs. But that's actually been a pretty interesting journey. And now that things are reopening, I'm sort of getting back into the live music world mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, well, being able to have the best of both worlds, man. Having that balance of studio time and live performances, that's certainly key for me. I love both as long as I get both.
Yeah.
For Germantown, so are you close to like Westchester?
Yeah, that's within like 20 miles or so.
Okay. Cool. I'm a
Seth, I'm a huge geography nerd, so I'm definitely going to have to, after this, I'm going to go one Wikipedia binge, Germantown, and then also check it out on Google Maps. And then, of course, Westchester, Vive La Bam, and the Margera.
Yeah, yeah, that's super close.
Yeah, nice, man. Awesome. Well, let's, so how long have you been playing trumpet? I'm assuming your trumpet playing began before your producing career.
Definitely. Yeah, I played trumpet growing up. Starting in probably fourth or fifth grade, I think, and did the whole, you know, band, orchestra, jazz band thing through high school. I did apply to music school for trumpet, got rejected, and probably it was probably a good thing. I didn't really have a plan. You know, I was just sort of going with that, and I'm not sure exactly what I would be doing with a classical trumpet degree. But I think that actually was sort of a blessing in disguise, and that it you know, really pushed me to explore some different types of music. You know, I think the classical trumpet background was really like very technically focused and not really a ton about creativity. I wasn't composing my own parts or writing songs or, you know, it was much more about playing things that were already written, and, you know, adding your own spin, of course. But, so I think, you know, taking a good amount of time off during college and a bit after really allowed me to start getting into, I tried out some different instruments, had a period playing like drums and percussion, and then, got introduced to reason, in college, which I'm a little bit older. So some of that stuff was like, it was sort of the early days of the DAWs. A lot of people were using like Pro Tools, Cubase. It was like Digital Performer, which was like pre-Logic. those were really difficult to use. And I couldn't really like connect the dots with that and music. Or I guess like the musician side of music. But, you know, Reason sort of had this really tangible interface and it like looked like the gear. And so that was sort of my start with production. But it was very like, sort of like Aphex Twin type stuff. Hadn't really gotten too much into dance music and was just making sort of like weird beats.
Mm-hmm. Which is how everyone should start out. Making something weird, man. Making something weird.
Yeah, for sure.
And Seth, so I really want to go back to you picking up the trumpet fourth or fifth grade. And as you were going through like middle school and high school, was band your main focus? Like, was that your main thing in the high school period?
In some ways, I think it was. I think if it was like viewed a little differently by the other students and my peers, I think it would have definitely been, you know, I don't think I didn't feel like it was really like necessarily respected or, you know, none of my friends necessarily thought that was cool, but they didn't like make fun of me for it either. And I kind of remember like with the jazz band, we would play before school assemblies sometimes. And it was just sort of like a mixed bet, you know, sort of like, sometimes the students seemed to appreciate it and think it was cool, and other times it felt like kind of embarrassing to have to perform in that like controlled way. But I didn't really. I did do cross country and track and some other sports a little bit, but yeah, I would say music in general was my main thing. I mean, I listened to mostly like punk and hardcore music then, so there wasn't really. I guess with like ska punk was pretty big then, so there was that overlap, but I never played in any ska bands or like incorporated my trumpet into that.
It's so funny you mentioned that. So I, similar to you, I started playing the saxophone in fifth grade, and I went to a small enough school where I was involved in pretty much everything. Just because I was able to, just because of the size of the school. I was captain of the wrestling team. I was a saxophonist, but I was in like FFA and National Honor Society and cross country. And I just had the opportunity to do most everything. And as much as I loved music, it definitely felt like the nerdy thing to do. And fortunately, I stuck with it and I didn't quit. Thankfully. But it is funny how we're so reliant on if other people think it's cool, right?
Yeah.
But I wonder with social media and the ability to connect so many different dots between passions, I wonder if that stigma necessarily still exists with musicians coming up. And I guess maybe it does. Who knows? I'll have to talk to somebody who's currently in high school dealing with that. But it is interesting. But where did you apply to music school?
At the University of Maryland. That's where I went to undergrad, but my trumpet teacher that I studied with in high school, his teacher was the trumpet instructor there. So I really like had a connection to and still didn't work out. But that was part of the reasoning for that. So not a conservatory, I guess, but
mm-hmm. Big Ten school. Cause I'm originally from Iowa. So Iowa and the University of Maryland, they played each other.
Oh, okay. I went to grad school in Ann Arbor at University of Michigan. So
oh, okay.
Two
nice.
Big Ten schools. Yeah.
I went to grad school, University of Dayton. So I would always hear, we were close to Ohio State. So I would always hear
right.
Ohio State people and Michigan people. It was pretty absurd.
It's
a rivalry, man.
Yeah, it's pretty insane. And when I was at Maryland, they were actually in the ACC. So it was a little, but still competitive in like basketball and stuff.
Mm-hmm. So walk us through your thought process of like you had this idea, this vision of going to undergrad and being a music major and playing trumpet, and then that didn't happen. Like what was the reformation that happened at that juncture in your life?
Well, I think it was a few different things. So part of the reason that I picked that school was they had an ethnomusicology program, which I didn't realize, I guess, at the time that was really like a grad program. Really a PhD program. So there were some classes you could take as an undergrad, but it wasn't like something you could major in.
Mm.
But because they had that, I actually got to play. They had a bunch of these like non-Western ensembles that were sort of formal, like a band or jazz band or orchestra or something. So I really took advantage of that. And so I played in this West African drumming ensemble, I think for all 4 years. And an Indonesian gamelan, which was super cool. So I think that really just started to like expand, you know, my perspective. And through that, I met some other musicians and did a lot more just like jamming, I guess, which I hadn't done a ton of before. I mean, I think mm-hmm. like jam bands were pretty big at that time. It was the early 2000s. So then, and you know, just started to get more exposed to, you know, playing myself and coming up with parts. And even like the West African ensemble and stuff was much more like improvised based than classical trumpet or saxophone or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It kind of, so it sounds like there was a door that kind of that got open once you really started focusing on improvisation. And For me personally, I wasn't a music major or a music minor during my undergraduate career, but I did do symphonic band and I took piano lessons and saxophone lessons, and it always baffled me to share conversations with the other saxophonists and how one the music program was just so intense. It didn't look fun. Like not very many of those students seemed happy. Like it seemed like
very serious,
super serious, dude. And I was coming at it from the fun improv perspective. And so that was, it was interesting to observe that and to even recognize within myself, like they're super talented musicians, but as I'm examining them, it's like, I don't think I want to be them. It doesn't look like they're having that creative a time right now. And I maybe the movie Whiplash is a good representation of that feeling.
Yeah. No, totally. And I think, you know, also, I guess in parallel to that, like throughout most of my life, I think I was always encouraged to take music seriously, but not necessarily like have it be my main thing. So, you know, I ended up going to undergrad for anthropology. And then I went to grad school for public health and didn't really like get super serious about music, I feel like, until I was in grad school and in Ann Arbor, which was really nice. But I sort of realized at that point, I was like, I need to move to a big city and like, I think I want to like try to play in a band. And, you know, try to like really, and that was sort of my late 20 or mid 20s. But I think that was really, really pivotal, in sort of like realizing after I'd already gone down the full time career route, which, you know, I'm still in some ways. But yeah, like really taking it seriously, you know, trying to, I guess, make it whatever that meant at the time. And so, you know, and that was actually when the trumpet came back up, because I was playing in a lot of these indie rock bands, playing keyboard, and it sort of came out that I played trumpet. And I think my bandmates were like, why have you been holding out on us? And I was like, I didn't know that was something that you thought was cool or that you wanted to add to the band. I was trying to like shift to playing keys.
That's so, dude, I can just imagine your bandmates of just like, are you kidding me, dude?
Yeah.
Like, what? You can play the trumpet? So is that like life epiphany number one? And I guess I say that as somebody that's had like a couple life epiphany moments, but that sounds like that was probably a big one for you.
Yeah, I mean, and then I was like identified as a trumpet player after that again, you know, mm-hmm. After like not doing that for 10 years or so, I think I was no longer, yeah. And then, then some other musical opportunities and stuff opened up through that. But yeah, very much as for the trumpet player, not for the guy that, you know, just casually played or played, mm-hmm. you know, growing up. And then I started taking lessons again too, because I was great. Like, shit, I, you know, and most of that, a lot of that was focused on like how to improvise, how to solo, like playing by ear, chord changes, you know, everything but reading music, I guess.
Yeah.
And I still do take private lessons from this guy. It's always been virtual. He's based in LA. But that's been really, really pivotal for me too.
Wow. And that's it's funny that you say that, because I haven't taken lessons in a few years at this point. And it's something in the back of my head of like, if I want to level up my playing, it certainly has to be through lessons. And so how do you enjoy the virtual lessons?
I mean, it works fine. I think I would really like to be in person, you know, ideally. And I, you know, we'll probably talk about it a little later, but I've had some recent experiences of like producing with people in person, in lo-fi as well. And that's been pretty different. But I think it works fine, you know, especially with the trumpet or something, you know, I can hear pretty well. You know, being able to record the lessons and watch them back is really helpful as well.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess just also the opportunity, you know, the trumpet teacher that I study with, I found him because he's the touring trumpet player with Louis Futon. I don't know if you know that artist.
Mm-hmm.
And he's actually from Philadelphia. Louis Futon's from Philadelphia. He sort of moved out to LA and got some recognition when he was pretty young. He may have been like still in high school.
Wow.
But my trumpet teacher Ari is his touring in his band. And so that, and I had been wondering like how to incorporate trumpet into a lot of my other music. Cause I also was producing at that time when I was playing in the indie bands and doing more like house music. And, but yeah, hadn't really been incorporating the trumpet. So seeing this guy do it and playing in like live electronic context, You know, I followed his page and saw that he was taking on students over Skype, and it turned out he went to Berkeley for trumpet and you know, had graduated pretty recently, at that time. So he really, like, I feel like it's taken a long time, but I feel like in a lot of ways he's sort of provided me with some of that, some of what I missed in, you know, going to a conservatory and like, the warmups they would do, or, you know, the way that his teachers would explain things, or, you know, the things that he worked on and solos that he transcribed and stuff, and you know, had a whole lot to draw on from that. And I think also just being like really well educated in that way, he's, and maybe, I mean, he gets some credit as well, but he's also just a really great teacher, which is, I think, its own skill.
Yeah, that's incredible. I wonder, do you know what year he would have graduated from Berkeley?
Would probably be like five, probably like 6 or 7 years ago, I guess.
Cause I, one of my main collaborators for Crystal Grip, Buglebot, he graduated from Berkeley, would have been like 4 or 5 years ago. And he was a trumpet. He is a trumpet.
Oh, player, so no way.
They might've. Yeah. What's your instructor's name again?
His name is Ariel Shrumpet. I'll send you his contact.
Yeah, that'd be incredible if Buglebot Ben knows him. That'd be sweet. So Seth, you're in these indie bands. You said you're working on some house music. So where did production come back in? Like in the same timeline as like when you brought the trumpet back?
Probably. I mean, I guess I had always been producing in the background. I think sort of just for fun. I did at that time also start DJing, and I sort of wanted to use DJing to help me get my production music, the music I was producing, like out into the world and help build that. But I think you know, it really, any success I had with the DJing really just got me more DJ gigs. And in retrospect at the time, I don't think my production skills were that great. So I think, you know, I did have some opportunities to get my music in front of people through DJing. And I think that I just, you know, I thought that I was up to the task at the time, but, in retrospect, yeah, I don't think the quality was there. So I think that sort of, I sort of interpreted that as you know, prioritizing like the live aspects. And then, you know, after the DJing thing, and I think I sort of just got tired of DJing, in terms of, felt like I was just like crowd pleasing, and I really never got to play like what I wanted to play. And I think that then I was sort of reminded of, well, if you're in a band or if you, you know, are a musician, there's no room to, you know, have people make requests or, you know, to try to crowd please. You just show up and you're like, I'm going to do my thing. You know, this is it.
Yeah.
There's no covers, no requests, no compromise in that way. And so I sort of started going back, into the live music thing, but this time more with like the, R&B, jazz and like funk artists, which was a very different world as well. Cause a lot of those bands were more like, you know, a group, you know, if you needed certain instruments and you would hire people for a specific thing and maybe have like one rehearsal, but a lot of people that could just sort of like show up and play, and people knew a bunch of shared songs. But that was like very, very heavily focused on the improv. But yeah, in sort of a different context. And a lot of those folks had jazz backgrounds, or church musicians. A lot of the musicians I played with grew up playing in church. So that was sort of what I was doing up until, I guess, until COVID hit.
Wow. Well, that sounds so intimidating for me to show up with a bunch of other jazz musicians and to test my chops.
They're like, just play. We're going to play, and, or maybe not even tell you the key or the chords.
Yeah, no, that's not a, nope. I have never done that. I like to have a well-prepared set and then go out and crush that set. That is certainly where my comfort level lies. But Seth, you said something that I thought was pretty profound, in regards to when you were DJing some of your own productions, and in retrospect, your productions weren't at the level of quality that you would need for it to be able to go pro, but you were still doing it anyway. And I think that that line of like confidence in cockiness, however you want to look at it, it's a pretty, pretty thin line between them, with the capacity for the actual skill that you have. I think it's important to overestimate yourself sometimes. Like thinking back on my first few years of production, if I didn't overestimate my abilities, I don't think I would have taken the chances that did allow me to grow in to excel. So kind of walk us through that, man, and your perspective on your own artistry and musicianship and in the confidence to get out on stage.
I mean, I did always push myself to try to at least be confident enough to put myself into uncomfortable situations. You know, joining a band, joining like an indie rock band, I wasn't even really listening to indie rock that much. Though that was just, at that time I was like looking for auditions and stuff on Craigslist, and that's sort of just what worked out. And I mean, I liked some indie rock bands. You know, with DJing, it was interesting because I think I actually waited too long before I started playing out, because I was approaching it from the same perspective of technicality as like trumpet or piano or something. And you know, I wanted to be able to like, and that was like the transition between, people were still using records. I did have like a Serato setup. Some of the other DJs that I played with, they were all vinyl. And it was pretty easy to switch with that, but I was learning on turntables and learning how to beat match and stuff on with records. And I feel like I felt like I needed to be like super proficient before having my first DJ gig. And then, you know, getting out there and realizing that like, it wasn't all about the technical skills, especially not in that. In that realm, but also, you know, like most of the other DJs that were successful weren't necessarily the most skilled at beat matching. So I think that was a good indication that sometimes it's about, you know, getting out there. I mean, I think a lot of people that perform live realize it's, you know, you don't always have to like audition or be the best band or artist. A lot of it's just being, you know, the one that's willing to put yourself out there and get up on stage and, you know, and you of course inevitably improve through doing. So, you know, when you're DJing all the time or when you're playing all the time, you'll inevitably get good doing that. But that initial push, has been tricky, I think, to overcome. But I think, you know, in live music, I've been much better about putting myself into those situations, even with the you know, playing with the sort of R&B and neo soul artists and stuff, I still encounter that. Actually, I just started playing with a band again this past week, so it's nice. Funny timing for this. And it's a funk band, which is really awesome. It just like worked out. I didn't really set out with any intention on joining. It just had some connections. You know, people were looking for a trumpet player. I thought it was for one gig, and it was like for a permanent horn section. But you know, all of these musicians are phenomenal. Like I'm definitely the weakest musician. And I think I've gotten in the habit of putting myself in that situation. When it comes to music and playing in bands and stuff, I think that I've sort of learned that I will, it's uncomfortable at first, but you know, I'll rise up to their level.
Yeah.
Through doing that. And, I think, you know, it's been tough to actually make that happen in the past, but I felt like this time around, I sort of although it felt very uncomfortable, and we had like one practice, and then they wanted me to play with them. From my first gig was like 2 days later. But you know, I think like drawing on that, on past experiences of that too, I just did it.
Yeah.
And it was okay. You know, and I think that's, you know, like you're that, you know, that the confidence to do that. You know, I think if I had told them that I didn't feel comfortable or, you know, didn't want to do that, you know, that might've compromised. That would have been a bad first impression. And they might've, mm-hmm. you know, been like, oh, this might not work out, you know, or think, yeah.
Seth, I think that's such an important philosophy to have. And I can't help but think about like a dance floor analogy. It's like the individual that's confident enough to like go out and start dancing, they don't even have to be a good dancer, yeah. right? But as long as they get out there and start dancing, everybody that's looking, nobody's thinking like, damn, they're a bad dancer. They're like, oh, wow, they have the guts to go out and dance. And I think that's so applicable for pursuing a new career, trying to create a new genre, build a new project, join a new band, like what, take on a new athletic endeavor. Like whatever it is, you have to have that ability to say like, I might not be very good, but you know, I'm going to go out and try and I'll do my best. And once you do that enough times, you realize that like, oh, well, sometimes even if you lose, quote unquote, lose whatever that looks like in a given situation, it's like, well, you learned and maybe you learn that something's not for you or you get inspired to be like, oh, okay, I did this wrong. I'm going to reevaluate and get better. But having that initial confidence to try, to not surrender to the fear of failure, you know, mm-hmm. like realizing like, man, well, if I fail, like what's the big deal? Cause I think, I mean, a lot of people are just paralyzed by, fear of chasing anything or going after anything. And I think the sooner that you can overcome whatever that fear is, the better off you're going to be. And, the more things that you're able to experience.
Yeah. I think about this in different ways with production a lot now, cause I think, you know, I still have lots of days and lots of times and, you know, my lo-fi stuff is by no means like successful, I guess the way that I would want it to be. But I think, you know, it's successful enough that I think I, have established this artistic project and, you know, it has getting some plays and some good collaborations and,
you know, only tens of thousands of people listen to it.
Right. No, it's yeah. I definitely don't take it for granted. You know, being someone that has, you know, had like no listeners or, you know, 100 plays on SoundCloud or something.
You're saying though, Seth.
Now it's like, I don't always think, you know, or even, you know, I had a song, luckily, you know, I've had a couple songs that hit, like lo-fi beats or something, which I guess is like the success, you know? And when I listen back to them, I'm like, oh my, I don't love what I did on trumpet or, you know, I don't think that actually sounds that good. But you know, I have to remind myself of that when I'm going back and listening to my songs and, you know, I'm about to like submit it to a label or something like that. And I have that doubt, you know, when I go back and listen and like, even if it doesn't sound good enough to me or at the level that I think it should be, I think I realize, I don't know if it's, I would say it's like not to trust that, but yeah, I guess like not to trust that doubt. Cause I think I also realize that, you know, some of the things that the songs that do well or, you know, things that other people like, I'm still critical of those when I mm-hmm. hear them and to not, you know, not worry about that too much and just keep going, keep putting things out. I mean, I think like the way that, you know, us lo-fi producers are so like prolific with releases helps with that too. Cause it's just like, you know, getting the songs out, like not leaving things unfinished and, you know, quality through quantity. Mm-hmm. And I had some, you know, advice with that earlier on in my production too, that it was like all about quantity. You know, you develop the quality that way, but
totally
make a bunch of songs, finish a bunch of songs, and don't stop. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, yeah, I think, you know, those doubts always will come up, and I've heard them, you know, I've heard the same thing, with many artists and many famous musicians at all different levels. And, you know, they all feel like imposters. No one thinks that they sound that good, even if they're, you know, top single on the Billboard charts and stuff. I mean, even when you have people telling you that, you know, in their mind, or, you know, it may never feel comfortable to you, or like you're, you know, where you wake up and you're just like, yeah, I killed that, you know, like, and learning how to still do it anyway, and still put yourself out there, I think. That's the struggle, but also is a habit, I guess, too.
Yeah. Well, and there's a lot of different, components to that. And I believe it's in Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers. I could be pulling this from the wrong book potentially, but, the author talked about an example of, there's like two photography classes at this university, and they split this photography group in half, and they ask one half of the class, or I guess the assignment to both groups is, by the end of the semester, you have to submit the best photo that you can create. And one group, their parameter was they had to take the perfect picture. And the other group, they were able to take as many pictures as possible to find the one perfect picture. And of course, the group that won that challenge was the group that was able to take 1,000 pictures and choose from 1,000 pictures. And so I certainly believe in that, the quality through quantity. And but there's also that balance, because it's so I have so many different passions that there's no way that I could be like the best at a single one of them, because I just do too much. But that's intentionally what I want to do. Where there's another person where they might just want to be the best saxophonist, and like that is what they're chasing, and that's cool too. So I think like figuring out like what gets you excited. And for me, it's like, okay, well, being good at a lot of different things gets me more excited than being great or the best at one specific thing. And I think kind of same thing with music for me. Like I personally love starting new ideas, right? Like my favorite part of a song is a blank Ableton template. And if I were to perfect every single song, you know, I would never get to do my favorite part of starting the next one. So I think it's figuring out that balance, figuring out that balance for yourself. And I guess for either whatever side of the spectrum you're on, you're only going to discover that through the work and sitting down and actually exploring those ideas. So that was, Seth, that was a really great point, man. And Seth, I do really want to touch on yoga and meditation, man. We've talked about music, but you're also super into yoga and meditation. So let's start going that route, because I really want to hear how you got to the place that you're at.
Yeah. Well, I think it also makes a lot of sense, because to talk about this as sort of a combined conversation, because I got into... Well, I guess I did my teacher training for yoga around the same time that I started getting into lo-fi, or started seriously having some lo-fi projects. So there was a big overlap there. I can't even really remember like which came first, but they've sort of been this sort of combined thing. And I mean, lo-fi music is also really good for practicing yoga with, and you know, I also use it in my yoga classes, but I think it all just sort of like fit well together. I think even some of the themes that people try to evoke and stuff with lo-fi, you know, there's a lot of overlap. But I did yoga. I've done yoga on and off for a long time, I think, like a lot of people. And I think one of the things that prevented me from getting like super into it was just not finding like a studio or a teacher that I really got inspired to do that with. So over the, like right when the pandemic started, a lot of yoga studios, at least in Philadelphia, I think didn't really know like how to transition into an online business. So they had a lot, there were a lot of free classes. And so I just tried classes at different studios, with different teachers. And I found this one studio, and teacher that I really resonated with. And I think I just, and at the time he was starting to transition to moving to Arizona. And so it sort of felt like the last opportunity to work with him, even though I had just met him virtually at that point. So I was also like in between jobs for a few months. So it was a good time to do a teacher training. I just sort of dove in. Everything was closed at that time. It was like at the height of lockdown. We still did it in person, but there was like a limited number of people and we were spaced out, and the studio itself was still closed to the public. So I think, you know, I was able to really like immerse myself in it during that time. Cause it was, and I think also part of the motivation was, you know, just when in some of those really difficult times, I think especially in that first year, first 6 months when things were like really scary and there was lots of anxiety and, things were very complicated. I noticed that yoga was just like the only thing that would help when I got into a mood or, you know, a rut or depression that I just couldn't get myself out of, you know, that was the thing that would help. And I live alone, which, you know, is really nice. And I think it was less complicated in a lot of ways, but, there were some periods of isolation or that, you know, like with the lockdown or the times when, you know, you think you were exposed or something and had to quarantine. So I would have these stretches of like weeks where it was just me and my dog. Mm-hmm. I was really like the benefits of doing yoga, and how much it was helping me, I think really just sold me on the importance of incorporating that. And I think, you know, all of that's also, I don't really have time for another hobby or like another pursuit. I felt like it was really like, yeah, I still feel like that. I don't really have time for it. But I just can't not do it. You know, yeah. It just really makes me feel, helps me feel normal. And I think gave me, you know, a better perspective on life in general and just helped me, you know, through a difficult time. And so I think also, you know, I didn't even necessarily intend on teaching. But I think sort of early on, I realized that I did really want to teach. And it's not something that I really do in other aspects of my life. But I think, you know, and so that was all like about 2 years ago that I finished that, and have been teaching ever since. I like the teaching part more than anything else. You know, I still practice, and I think the studio that I trained at is very big on like the philosophy and spirituality aspect. You know, the physical practice is important, but was not necessarily like the primary focus. But yeah, I think that it's sort of surprising how much the teaching has really, really resonated and also kept me committed and kept me, you know, involved with it. And I have a really cool studio that gives us a lot of like creative freedom. And I think, you know, we can sort of bring as much as we want. So I've tried to incorporate lo-fi music as like a lo-fi lunchtime class. I don't think it really caught on, but a lot of people would like ask me for the playlists. Cool. But I am going to try to do a class in the fall where somebody else will be teaching and I'll do like a live lo-fi set.
Awesome.
So try to like force that, yeah. force that, the music. And I think people will get it, you know, when they see it. It seemed like a connection that I kind of wish more yoga people, I guess, would latch onto that. Cause I think there is a lot of like corny, contrived yoga music that sort of like rips on other genres. And I feel like, you know, there's no reason that you can't have good quality music in a yoga. It doesn't have to be, yeah, this like contrived new age smooth jazz yoga music.
Dude, I discovered Chill Cole through the Vinyasa Flow playlist on Spotify. It's his song Surrounded by Nature. And I remember I heard it, and it's like one of my favorite songs of all time. But it was on a Spotify yoga playlist. But,
nice.
Seth, but so I mean, you dove in deep. So how long were you doing yoga before the pandemic?
Probably like on and off for maybe like 5 or 6 years, and I had periods in there where I'd go like every week, you know, for a couple of years, and then sort of fall off. And I did do some like home practice, sort of on and off. But I would say, about 5 or 6 years before that. But I was never really like that. I guess it's not really something that you're supposed to be good at. But it didn't really come that easy to me. I'm not very flexible at all. It wasn't like I don't have a dance or gymnastics background or some things that can really help people pick up yoga super quick. But I think it was partially like having a teacher and learning in a way from someone that was also not flexible, not a typical yoga body person. And I think that's also part of my motivation to teach that is to, you know, present it to people in this way. Like, you don't have to be able to do it. You know, you don't have to be able to touch your toes to do yoga. We can help modify the poses so anybody can do them, but it's not a practice that's just for people that are bendy or flexible. It's really something that can be adapted to wherever anybody is, you know, physically and mentally.
Yeah. Well, it's so great from the educational perspective, man. And I think, what I try to do, and I don't know if I do a good job at it, but, like through social media posts, through conversations, I love to work hard. Like that's, it makes me happy. And so like showing other people, like, you don't have to be like Superman to work hard. Yeah. And that's my passion of like teaching people, like, oh, do you have like, is there a outrageous goal that you want to try to hit? Like, oh, well, you can chase it. You can get up early and hustle for it. Like all you got to do is set your alarm and wake up.
Totally.
I certainly resonate with that, Seth. And you'd mentioned track and cross country in high school. So what were you doing physically before you found yoga?
Really just like typical strength training and stuff at the gym. And I mean, I still do some of that, although of course it's like all at home. You know, I do a lot of stuff with kettlebells and I have like a exercise bike. Cause I think, yoga is good, but I don't think any yoga teacher, well, I don't, shouldn't say that, but I think there's more recognition now, especially in the yoga world, that like people need to be cross training. That shouldn't be the only type of physical activity you do. I mean, it's great if for people that are inactive, you know, to become more active, but there's a lot of strength required in yoga. I think that's sort of a misconception that it's more about flexibility and you know, a lot of people come and they just don't have that. And that can definitely, open you up to injuries and also just make things difficult to be able to, you know, do a handstand or something like that. It takes a ton of upper body strength, shoulder strength, core strength. And you're probably not going to get that from going to a Vinyasa class once a week. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So was obviously there's something about yoga that really resonated with you. Did you have that feeling like when you would, when you were just regularly working out, like, did you have that connection with it of like, oh, this makes me feel good, that's why I do it?
I think that's what's kept me exercising. I think I always, you know, would always say that it was more of a mental health than physical health thing for me. And I sort of recognize that. I've recognized that since I was probably a teenager. But I think the big difference was, and this is sort of how this teacher that I worked with framed it, is it really a spiritual practice? And so I think that makes it very different from other types of workouts. And I think not everybody treats yoga that way. And I think that there, yoga can mean like a lot of different things nowadays. And there's sort of not really like one pure type of yoga. But I think for me, that was what really made it stick. And that's not something I really had before.
Mm.
Like a spiritual practice or something that I prioritized in that way. And I think it really was all about having that presented to me in the specific way that I think, my teacher, he's great at doing it. It's not the only one. He started his legacy, I guess, with the studios having like a heavy metal Mondays class. And, nice. A lot of the teachers that work at the studio and this guy as well is they're sort of like covered in tattoos, you know, like wear all black, like look like they're in metal bands. I think that feels very accepting and inviting for a lot of people that mm-hmm. might typically not feel comfortable in a yoga studio or, you know, feel like it's not for them or not targeted towards them. So I think the way that it's presented is so important.
Wow. It's incredible. And over the past year, I've read all of Michael Singer's books, and he's kind of, those books are the first time that I, where he's talking about yogis, like almost purely from the spiritual perspective. And so that was a change in terminology for me. And I've done a few yoga classes. So in high school, wrestling was my main focus, which I think there's a decent amount of crossover in between wrestling and yoga. And so I had a yoga poster in like my wrestling room, and I would just go through the poses on my own. So there wasn't anybody walking me through the spiritual experience of it, but I think I certainly could see how that would apply. And of course, you know, any other stereotype about meditation and yoga, I'm sure influenced that as well. But it's interesting reading Michael Singer's books and learning about yogis in yoga practices from that spiritual lens, because that's not that's not something that I thought about until I read those books.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's all. I mean, yoga, I guess traditionally yoga is a meditation tradition. You know, the physical practices of it are fairly recent, and mostly the purpose of them is really just to allow you to be able to sit for longer periods of time and be still. So I think, you know, yoga has a complicated history, and I think what the things that really took off in the West were the physical practices of it. And then, you know, it, as the interest sort of waxed and waned, I think in the 80s, it really sort of fell off. And then in the 90s, you know, we saw some more of the like power yoga and the fitness part of it really stuck. And that, you know, intentionally separated from the spirituality.
Does it get more Western than that?
Right. But I mean...
That's what we do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely complicated. I think, you know, at the same time, you know, one of the interesting things is that like in India as well, the interest also sort of fell off. And because it's become so popular in the West, that sort of like reignited the interest in India, you know, where it is originally from. So I think it's as much appropriation and I guess, you know, shaping the, the way that it's done and sort of maybe, you know, missing some of the important components, it's also helped to spread it and also, yeah, also reigniting the interest in, you know, some of the country or the cultures that it's from. And I mean, I you know, don't want to speak from like a expertise perspective, because I think it's, you know, it's not my tradition that I grew up in. It's something that's fairly new to me. I think, you know, teaching, I have to sort of be somewhat definitive with things and not just say I don't know, but I think it's a very broad area. And I think, you know, what like traditional yoga is really more of like a philosophy that's much more a part of Hinduism, and I guess was a precursor for Buddhism. And so I think it being a physical practice now is not, it depends on who you talk to and I guess how people think of it, you know, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. But I think, you know, the ways that it's been explained to me is that, you know, one of the ways that you can sort of approach this, self-discipline practice is, you know, the easiest way is to start with like the grossest layer, which is the physical body. You know, then you move into more subtle things like the breath work. And then, you know, that's sort of a very logical path to introducing people to more spirituality, you know, to a more practice of, you know, identifying this idea in yoga of like this higher version of yourself that's this separate entity from your body and from your mind and your ego that's, you know, who you really are, that you need to be reminded of. And so, at the same, you know, the physical practice can be a great way to do that, you know, to help create self-discipline, to help focus the mind. I mean, it's really similarly to meditation, you know, it's a similar goal, and, you know, in a similar way to other intense physical practices, it inevitably controls your mind, because it's hard to think about anything else when you're, you know, pushing your body physically. Mm-hmm. So it sort of can be like a shortcut, I think, for Westerners in some ways. And since we're so, you know, high energy and have difficulty focusing, you know, it seems like doing a really intense yoga practice physically is a great way to create that stillness and to sort of work off some of that extra energy and, you know, allow you to get into those more subtler aspects.
Mm-hmm. Which is so important. And so, so tell us a little bit more about your spirituality and kind of the experience that drew you, into yoga. And I guess I can preface that by saying, one, running is certainly my spiritual, practice for sure, of like running in the mountains, man, like that. It's certainly my medicine. And, you know, with the ultra marathons, you know, once you're at mile 30, it's hard to think about anything aside from
right.
that next step. don't fall. And then I've been sober for a year and a half. And that has allowed me to really look at spirituality in a different aspect. And it's been so freeing to be able to explore that aspect of existence. And it's something that I practice every single day to try and get in touch with the better version of myself, and to try to destroy the ego a little bit every single day. So, tell me about your experience, man.
Well, I think one of the things that, I guess, and I have also had a meditation practice, that I think yoga allowed me to get into. So, you know, I did have some moments within doing both of those when I would just sort of feel some sort of intense bliss. Maybe it was, you know, a passing thing. But I think what really got me connected and sort of closed the loop, I guess, with yoga and yoga spirituality was the tradition and the lineage that I guess my studio is based on, and that my teacher is a part of, has a big component of music. And so there's this And these ideas of sacred sounds and sacred frequencies and vibrations. And so one of the main types of practice is what's called a kirtan. And it's like this group sort of call and response chanting, which is similar to singing, and sort of the same mantras over and over and over again, maybe for, you know, as long as 30, 40 minutes. And it's, I guess it's sort of like, I think there are lots of ecstatic practices that people can do that can sort of alter your state, you know, in a non-substance related way. And so I think that part of this tradition or whatever, you know, I think that easily sort of resonated with me. And, you know, I think a lot of my sort of spiritual experiences in the past have come from music, you know, or playing with people, or, you know, that feeling when you just get goosebumps and, you know, I feel like I can feel when I like, when music does something for me or not, you know, it's like this immediate thing. And it's a sensation that's separate from the sound itself, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think that, so I think, you know, these practices have evoked that same sort of feeling. So I think that made it sort of a bit easier to connect to. And then I think also just, you know, with the world in the middle of the pandemic and things being so bleak, you know, I had never really considered the idea of like a higher power or, you know, and I think that the idea that sort of this physical world is all that there is, and as it's sort of crumbling around us, and, you know, people are being terrible to each other, and it was just such a landslide down, it felt like, for humanity. I think it really, really made me question that, you know, is there something else going on? Is there something greater? And I think I sort of, you know, in the past had been really a strong atheist and really, you know, anti-religion, and never having any real bad experiences with it myself, luckily. But I think that I think being sort of pushed to the brink, as a lot of us were, I think it really started making me long for a different perspective or a different way to see things. And I think, you know, I'm still don't have that certainty, I guess, as far as, you know, whether some of these ancient teachings and ideas of higher powers are true or not. But I think my choice and the way that I live and my beliefs are more of, you know, being more optimistic. And I think just seeing the benefit of, like, you know, like you had mentioned, I was actually listening in your episode with Odd Panda. I think you had a quote from the Bhagavad Gita, which is like about what this practice called karma yoga, which is not, there's no like poses. It's all about working and doing what, you know, playing your role, doing your work without being attached at all to the outcome. And I think, you know, and one of the biggest teachings of that book is taking that a step further, is like offering that up to a higher power, where it's really not about you or what you're doing, or, you know, that there's no benefit, and really, you know, that's what allows you to take your ego out of it. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, whenever I have doubts about that stuff, or the existence of that, or, I think I just recognize the benefit of living that way. And, you know, sort of taking yourself out of it. And it's been explained to me as well that, you know, whether you think of this as like this big old man in the sky, or, you know, there's higher powers that we experience, like storms and, you know, volcanoes and, meteors. And, you know, there are all these things that make us very small as far as, you know, our position in the world and in the universe. And I think that's a helpful perspective to have. Not that we're not important, but also, you know, we all feel like we're the center of the universe. Yeah. And so, you know, getting out of that, I think, is pretty beneficial for most people.
Yeah, man. Well, and Seth, that's beautiful. And I had mentioned that, you know, my spiritual experience had come from sobriety, and it wasn't necessarily, it wasn't sobriety because everything was going smooth. It was sobriety because something had to change.
Right.
And the subsequent spiritual experience of that, and the ego destruction that occurred through that process is, certainly the best thing that has ever happened to me. And it's such a more freeing way to live. And in that quote from the Bhagavad Gita, it's, I try to live by that as closely as possible. And kind of like I mentioned earlier, like working hard makes me happy. And I'm certainly trying to accomplish end goals, certainly. But I'm trying to focus less if it's out of my control, like, you know, that's okay. Perfect. Well, then I try not to stress about that. And when I first began to explore spirituality and that idea of surrendering to life, like that was as a high achiever, that was a very hard concept. I was like, what do you mean? How am I going to accomplish anything if I surrender? And I was totally missing the point. And, since adopting that ideology, I've accomplished more than I've ever accomplished. Mm. And it's, and I get to do it happily. And it's, I would have never thought that achievement would have come through surrender, but it certainly has for me, man. And the amount of energy that comes from it. And really, I guess it's most importantly, the happiness. Regardless of what I accomplish, it's like how happy I am doing it. That's mm-hmm. the best part. My happiness levels have increased tenfold. And I'm so grateful for it, dude. And it's, you know, as somebody that, if you would have talked to me a couple years ago or a few years ago, like I was a proponent of psychedelics, so I could talk about the universe. I could talk about a spiritual experience through DMT. I could talk about love. I could talk about nature. You know, but if you would have brought up like spirituality, like on the nose, or if you would have said God or higher power, I would have been like, stop with your nonsense. And now, in hindsight, it's like, oh, that's what I was talking about the whole time. There was just something about my ego that couldn't allow me to connect it with somebody coming from a spiritual lens, and how freeing. And yeah, man, I'm grateful for it. And figuring out whatever experience can bring you to that, whether it's through yoga or running or an extremely low bottom where you mm-hmm. finally give up, whatever that cause is, it's like, oh my goodness, man. I'm certainly grateful for my spiritual experience. And now, and I think most importantly, now that I've tasted it, like I'm chasing that chasing growth in that area every single day.
Amazing. Yeah. I think it's interesting. You know, I think with like the increased popularity of psychedelics, I think it's an important topic that should be discussed a bit more. 'Cause I think, you know, psychedelics can be a useful tool. And I think, you know, that can really open people up to things that you may not have been open to, like ideas of spirituality or, you know, some greater interconnectedness. But I think at the same time, it's important. And I think they can be done as part of a spiritual practice. But I think it's important not to mistake them as a spiritual practice, just, you know, when you're partying or something like that.
Totally. Yeah.
Cause I think there's definitely a misconception that it like taking lots of psychedelics makes you spiritual inherently. Yeah.
Well, and it's, and fortunately, so I had, man, probably from like 16 to 25 ish. Like I probably had like six or seven very impactful psychedelic experiences, where primarily for a majority of them, like I was going in with the spiritually focused, fortunately, luckily, thankfully. But there was never a maintenance program to follow up on those experiences to maintain whatever I learned. And like this sobriety journey that I've been on for the past year and a half, like I often call it soberdelic, because it's I have had so many soberdelic experiences in the past year and a half that it's unbelievable, man. Like finishing a run and like almost being brought to tears just because I'm happy, you know. Yeah. And maybe it was just like a 5-mile run, you know, like just something normal. I've had so many profound experiences with a quote unquote normal, with normal life, that I wouldn't change it for the world. But I do agree. I'm still like, even, as somebody that's sober, I don't feel that I need any more psychedelic experiences. Like if I did, like it would probably be silly. Everything I just said would probably sound silly of like, oh, well, what you're having, like normal, like at noon on a Wednesday, that's not enough. which would be, you know, spoken like a true addict. So currently I am very content with, my spiritual experiences, but still a proponent of psychedelics, but a proponent of psychedelics, certainly with care, just like anything. I'm a proponent of running, but if you're going to go run an ultra marathon in the mountains, like, yeah, there's probably a little prep, a little prep work to be done before embarking on that journey.
Totally. Yeah, no, and same, and I'm not even, you know, I wouldn't claim to be sober necessarily myself, but I think, just sort of separating spirituality from substances and also just, yeah, trying to be in touch with yourself in ways that are not altered, I think is also an important component, you know, whether or not you do that. And I guess the last thing that I was just reminded of when you were saying about, you know, having like ecstatic moments, or I guess I'll call them that, you know, in normal life. I think one of the most like profound things that I learned from my yoga teacher, and I think it's sort of his interpretation of really the wisdom in the Bhagavad Gita, because not to get too in the weeds, but the Bhagavad Gita is supposed to be advice for like the average person. It's not supposed to be for a monk or a renunciate, and it's actually sort of deterring the main character Arjuna from doing that. Mm. And you know, this idea that like your spiritual practice is how you live your life. It's not like meditating in a cave for 20 years. It's how you, as a, you know, they call it a householder, but as a regular person, you know, how you operate in the world, you know, that should be your spiritual practice.
Yeah.
Doesn't need to be any more elaborate or, any more elaborate than that. It's, And I think that's a perfect example of that, is, you know, that's just as meaningful as, you know, an experience in a temple or, you know, in some other situation that might be, you know, considered more inherently spiritual, but not being so limited in that view.
Yeah. Well, and I couldn't agree more, man. And that's like, that was never something on my goal list. Which, you know, in hindsight is absurd. That's not where I wanted to grow. Or I didn't place any importance on it, but, now that it, like, and that's, you know, something that I've learned from Michael Singer as well, is like every moment is an opportunity to grow spiritually. Good, bad, and different. Like every moment, like something doesn't go your way. Like, oh, this is a moment to grow spiritually. Or if something does, oh, this is a moment to grow spiritually. And like the more I can remind myself, the happier I am, man, the more simple life becomes, you know. Mm-hmm. Like even things that are like bad, like a bad experience. If you come in with that mindset, it's like, oh, okay, let me get out of myself for a second and try to see the bigger picture. And Seth, we have been yapping for a long time, dude.
Yeah,
so let's wrap this conversation up. This was a phenomenal episode, man. And thanks for sharing your story. Thanks for opening up and going deep in conversation with me, man.
Absolutely.
I'm really glad that we were finally able to make this happen, dude. And
me too. I appreciate you having me, and appreciate everything you do with this podcast. It's, you know, you created this whole community that I think is you know, we're all super grateful to have it. And I think, you know, we couldn't have done it without you.
Well, Seth, thanks, man. And yeah, I'll try and keep doing what I'm doing. And I think coincidentally, you're going to be episode 100.
Oh, nice.
Which is pretty cool, man.
It's a big milestone.
That is, man.
That's a lot of episodes.
Even when I started the podcast, like the very first one was 001 with that intention of like,
oh yeah.
Yeah. I'm going into the hundreds with this. And here we are, man. So that is pretty cool. And, yeah, Seth, thanks again, dude. I'm going to put all your links in the bio as always. Everybody tuning in, thank you. Thank you for listening and supporting. And Seth, we'll get you back on, relatively soon, man. Let's wait a few months and we're going to get you back on. I don't think we're done talking about spirituality.
Yeah, definitely more to say as well.
Perfect. Seth, thanks again, brother. Everybody tuning in, much love. Peace.
Thanks, Cody.